As I get towards the end of the course, there is a certain very real frustration in knowing how to pull things together and what specific topics to include. I find it even more so this year because this is the last time officially I'm going to teach the course. It's conceivable I'll offer it as a single course in years ahead, but I think unlikely. And I think that really gets me thinking very deeply in some ways about where we are in terms of the relation to the environment, because I think it's one of the factors that individuals face as they move towards retirement. You tend to get a little philosophical. You look at your own career, wonder if you've really achieved very much, if you've made much of a difference. And you tend to look sometimes at the larger picture of where we are as a society, how we all fit together. And sometimes that's not the easiest thing to do, because I think most of us, if we're reasonably honest, we realize that life has been a strange mixture of success and failure. You think back on things that you've done reasonably well. You think back on people you've hurt and situations where you've not been at your best. You look at various intellectual academic positions you've taken, which haven't always held up well over the years. And that seems to me to be just part of the human condition. As I mentioned in an earlier class, when I first started writing on environmental ethics back in the middle 1960s, I was a convinced Clemencian, believing that there was this kind of mystical harmony in nature that you could establish scientifically, that ecology was really unfolding all of these wonderful balances, and concepts like harmony and integrity and so on were very, very appealing to me, as they were to many writers on environmental issues. And it's been a bit of a jolt, I think, for me in terms of thinking about these issues, to realize that there isn't much good science to back that up. It really came as a kind of jolt as I began to read more in the literature about catastrophe, opportunism, discontinuity, in the sense that it looks as if we had read into nature a degree of harmony and balance and so on that we really wanted to be there, but which in a way could not easily be found in nature itself. And I think in all of our different intellectual efforts, we find that kind of situation. I was thinking about this just recently within my own tradition as a Christian. I argue that God values all of the species, all of the various parts of nature. But it certainly doesn't make it any easier to affirm that when you look back at geological history and the history of the planet and look at these huge crashes of asteroids that wipe out half of all the species and do all kinds of bad things. If you look at the explosion at Yellowstone when the crater 27 miles across in diameter, when the crater blew and put 500 cubic miles of crud into the atmosphere about 600,000 years ago. I sometimes wake up and say, God, you could have done just a little nicer job with it all. If you value all these species, looks like you're asleep at the helm. What's going on? I mention that because it would seem to me that one of the realities we face in the modern world is that all intellectual, academic, philosophical, religious positions do seem to have points at which the argument becomes difficult. I think one of the crises that traditional biblical religion faced was the challenge, say, of modern evolutionary biology. It's hard in some ways to square that with some of the biblical accounts. And so whatever position we take in our thinking about the environment, there are these problems we face in terms of how the position fits together. I've already mentioned that, for instance, in classical philosophical ethics, there often is a great deal of clarity, and we've gotten a great deal of help in unpacking some of the very difficult ethical situations we face. But traditional philosophical ethics says almost nothing about motivation and empowerment. It makes what seems to me a somewhat facile assumption that if you know the truth, you will do it. If you know what's just, you will live accordingly. And that's one of the kinds of problems that's faced in that tradition. I'd like this morning to just take a little bit of an overview of three, perhaps the three dominant positions that we might take in how we approach the environment: anthropocentrism, biocentrism, and theocentrism. In much of the literature today, theocentrism is ignored, yet it seems to me that it is, in some ways, a position that, at least in our own society, a great many people take. And I'd like to look just briefly at a few of the strengths and weaknesses of these different positions: anthropocentrism, biocentrism, and theocentrism. Anthropocentrics, and I think a fine example of this would be the material we read, say, from Joseph Sachs, Mountains Without Handrails. Joseph Sachs is basically, at least in terms of the approach he takes in that book, what I would call an enlightened anthropocentric. He really looks at the treatment of nature mainly in terms of how nature affects humans, what investment humans have in nature, how we can relate to nature in a way that will result in human flourishing. And it's a position that in many ways is extremely attractive, because we do realize that if we treat nature well, on the whole, human life will probably be better. If we beat up on nature sufficiently, it's fairly easy to see that our lives may be a good deal worse. And Sachs, in his work, gives us some help with this. He talks about, in particular, the use of the national parks and how we might use them for more contemplative activities and so on. It is a kind of a sophisticated or benign form of anthropocentrism, in my view. He argues very persuasively that it's not adequate to view nature simply as a resource, simply as raw material for human satisfaction, that there are other ways that we can look at nature. Now, in some ways, the whole liberal tradition, going back to John Locke, fits in mainly with the anthropocentric point of view. It's easy today to be critical of modern liberalism, liberalism now with a capital L, but I think it's important for us to realize that liberalism in some ways unleashed an enormous amount of human energy and creativity. In some ways, the feudal system, the role of the church, very fixed status and roles that people played, in some ways it was stifling. People, in many cases, who were extremely bright, extremely capable people, were not able really to find ways to make use of the abilities they had. And I think as we sometimes today are critical of modern liberalism, it's all too easy to overlook the positive benefits that it had. And to some extent, I think today, if we really are honest with ourselves, to some extent all of us are liberals in the classical sense in which both Democrats and Republicans would fall under liberalism. Most of us do believe in a social order where government is less rather than more intrusive, where people have the opportunities to develop their abilities and their skills. Just a couple words about John Locke and his understanding of land. This is from the Second Treatise of Government, which was originally published in 1690. Locke argued that, and I quote, "Though the earth and all inferior creatures be common to all men, yet every man has a property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his." Now, this already is a very, very interesting statement because at another level, of course, the standard theological position of the day was that ultimately God owns both the self and the fruits of one's labor, that one lives in a fiduciary role in relation to God. But Locke continues, he says, "Whatsoever then the individual removes out of that state, the state that nature has provided and left it in, he has mixed his labor with and joined to it something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property." He has a very interesting and novel view of property. There are things that exist in common, like bananas on the trees or nuts on the trees or whatever grows wild. But if you invest your time and energy in picking the bananas or gathering the nuts or whatever it is, that this results in your having a kind of legitimate claim to that as your own property. But Locke adds two interesting provisos or limitations. He says, this is so, at least where there is enough and as good left in common for others. You shouldn't grab it all for yourself. You shouldn't be greedy in a way that causes other people to suffer. And he believed that even in England of his own day, there was still plenty of land and resources. And he pointed also to America and the unlimited land in the New World. I think he over-exaggerated the situation in England. I think much, perhaps most of the good land had already been taken over by that time, but that's the way his argument runs. And then he has a second proviso. He says, so long he may consider this his own property, so long as he does not take so much for himself that it spoils. You shouldn't gather so many bananas or nuts or whatever you can gather from the common that it ends up spoiling because you can't use it. That also seems like an irrational thing to do. Now, as I said, he partly answers the first proviso by pointing to the unlimited land and resources in America. And the second one, he answers in a very interesting way that I find even less satisfactory. He said, now, we can resolve this by the creation of money, because you can trade your surplus for money, and that doesn't spoil. And that's a very, very interesting argument, in a way, that I think to some extent makes sense. But on the other hand, I think paves the way for some of the gross inequities that we have found in the modern world of almost obscene wealth in some cases, and then much suffering on the other hand. Now, more generally, going back to Locke and Adam Smith and Hume and others, modern English liberalism, classical liberalism, tended to understand rational behavior as self-interested behavior. And here are many of the modern roots. Here are many of the roots of modern anthropocentrism. Rational behavior is self-interested behavior. Humans, to a considerable degree, are presented as atomistic individuals, basically egocentric. In a negative way, I sometimes think that Locke presented a view of human beings as as a kind of small shopkeeper, always keeping accounts, always looking out for his own interest, and so on. The emphasis is on the autonomous self, the self as choosing its own way of life, in a sense of ultimately being responsible to itself, making its own laws, and so on. And this contrasts very, very sharply with older views of the self as existing under God, or views such as the Stoics, in ancient classical, the classical world of the self living, quote, according to nature, and so on. Modern liberalism has focused a great deal on rights and on justice as over against concepts of the good life. We've talked about this a little already. The role of the state is not to define for you how you ought to live, what the good life is. It ought to simply keep you from harming other people. And along with this is a strong focus on preferences. Reason is seen sometimes in contrast to reason is seen in the service of desire. As Locke and others put it, reason is in the service of passion. Reason is what helps you get what you desire or want. And in all of this, of course, you see that human beings are very much at the center of this way of thinking. Now, this contrasts very, very sharply with older philosophical and religious views of property and also of the human being. St. Augustine, for instance, said this. He said, "Find out how much God has given you, and from it take what you need. The remainder which you do not need is needed by others. The superfluities of the rich are the necessities of the poor. He who retains what is superfluous retains the goods of others." That's a very radical view of property. If you are wealthy and have things that are utterly superfluous, and people around you are starving, are needy, you basically are a robber, a thief. You're possessing what does not rightly belong to you. This is a radically different concept that at least ideally pervaded throughout the earlier period. St. Thomas Aquinas's view of property, which was largely drawn from Aristotle and from the Jewish scriptures, also was very different from Locke's view. St. Thomas argued, he said, two things are competent to man with respect to exterior things. One is the power to procure and dispense them, and in this regard it is lawful for man to possess property. Moreover, this is necessary to human life for three reasons. He says, first, you'll probably take better care of property if it belongs to you rather than if it's held in common, and that's a fairly ordinary experience that we have. He says, secondly, because human affairs are conducted in more orderly fashion if each person is charged with taking care of some particular thing himself, whereas there would be confusion if everyone had to look after any one thing indeterminately. And thirdly, he argues a more peaceful state will likely exist and there will be fewer quarrels if there is a reasonable division of things. So St. Thomas Aquinas, following Aristotle, makes a strong argument for private property, but it is a very different argument from that of Locke because he qualifies it in this way. And again, here he draws directly from Aristotle. St. Thomas says, the second thing that is competent to man with regard to external things is their use. In this respect, man ought to possess external things not as his own, sounds very much like Augustine before him, ought to possess external things not as his own, but as common, so that to wit he is ready to communicate them to others in their need. This sounds, to some extent, like modern socialist, almost Marxist theory. You pay attention to the needs of others, and of course that's understandable because Marx and Lenin and so on drew many of their basic justice insights from Judaism and from Christianity. So here I think we see already in the rise of modern liberalism and modern views of property and modern understandings of the self, I think something of the problems of anthropocentrism. It can easily become very ego-centered, very much centered on the welfare of the autonomous individual self. There can be a neglect of nature as possessing value outside of its instrumental value for humans, and in some ways can result not just in a ravaging of nature, but in a great deal of problems for human beings as well. And yet anthropocentrism has a lot to commend it in the sense that enlightened anthropocentrism can result in a very fine treatment of nature. Now, what about biocentrism? Biocentrism, in some ways, is extremely appealing. As I read some of the works of people like Paul Taylor in his book, Respect for Nature, there is something that resonates well with me, and that writers like Paul Taylor seem to have a kind of intuitive sense that there's something radically wrong with viewing nature simply as a resource. That to see nature just in terms of what we can exploit and control and dominate, and to neglect as strongly as we have done nature's intrinsic or inherent value, that there's something extremely wrong with this. And I think this is part of the attraction of the biocentric position. And it's a position that in the last 30 years or so has gained a great deal of currency and purchase. It's the position probably that largely dominates environmental education in K through 12 schools, and to some extent is reasonably widespread even at the college and university level. The problem that I see with biocentrism is not in that initial motivation or the sense of wanting to increase respect, wanting us to pay more attention to what a wonderful, mysterious, rich, valuable reality nature is. The problem that I see with anthropocentrism is, how do you implement it? How do you actually make it work for you? That's one of the problems. I'll speak to another one presently. That is, particularly if you take a really radical biocentric position, Paul Taylor argues that even a dandelion or a violet or a tree is as valuable as a human being. I don't know what you do with that. What do you do after you've said that? Because it seems utterly, totally impossible to implement it. So where do you go? So I'm attracted in a way to some of the motivation that presents this position, but I don't know very well what to do after I have it out on the table. Now, somebody like Peter Singer or Tom Regan are not really biocentrics. They are more concerned, in fact, largely concerned, for the well-being of sentient animals, or animals, as Regan puts it, that are the experiencing subject of a life. And in some ways, when we've talked a little bit about this in discussion section, there is a tension between animal welfare, animal rights thinking, and ecological concern on the other hand. Because sometimes it would seem if you care about the larger ecosystem, you will thin the herds of elk in Yellowstone. You will probably kill some of the burros in the Grand Canyon because you care about their impact on the larger ecosystem. So strictly speaking, Singer and Regan are not biocentrics, their major concern really is for our treatment of animals. But the concern I have here, as I've mentioned, is what do you do once you've stated a biocentric position? Some writers have argued that we ought to assign rights to animals or even to trees and other living objects. But again, what does that do? How do you implement that? Does every tree have a lawyer assigned to it? Do all the species of animals? What would it mean to have rights in a practical way? And most philosophers, whether secular or religious, who have thought about the problem, have come to realize that that presents just incredible difficulties. How do you even begin to think about that coherently if you begin to talk about rights for animals and rights for plants and so on? Where do you go from there? So one of the major problems I find with biocentrism is the problem of implementation. The other problem is that in some ways, and perhaps somewhat counterintuitively at first, biocentrism doesn't seem to square all that well with modern scientific insight. If you take a position, say, of the evolutionary biologist, it's not just a position that creates some problems for the traditional Jew or Christian in terms of reconciling modern evolutionary theory with traditional biblical concepts and so on. It's also a problem in some ways for the biocentric, because the view we have of nature that the scientist takes, a nice example would be Carl Sagan, is that all that we see around us, plants, animals, humans, all of us are ultimately the result of misprints in DNA capitalized on by natural selection, and that everything we see around us really is purely accidental. It could have been many other things than the way it is. Or, as Sagan puts it at one point, nature doesn't give a damn about you and me. And yet, oddly, Sagan, in the same Cosmos series, argue that we owe responsibility and we owe respect to this cosmos, ancient and vast, as he puts it, from which we spring. The cosmos doesn't give a damn about us, but we owe all this allegiance to the cosmos. That's jarring, in a way. That doesn't quite work too well for many people. Why do we owe this kind of respect? Why is it so important to preserve species if all of them are purely accidental anyway? What's so great about all these different species when there's no rhyme nor reason in one sense why they're there? They're all the end results of accidental mutations. Now, as I've already said, that's not a problem simply for the biocentrics. I find it somewhat jarring theologically that if God values all the species so much, how come he didn't do a slightly better job in preserving some of them? An awfully lot of them are extinct. In fact, probably 98% or more over the millions and millions of years. So here again would be some problems that would come up in a biocentric position. Now, theocentric positions aren't talked about that much in environmental studies and in K-12 curricula, and I think that's unfortunate because, and also inaccurate, because more or less probably a majority of Americans think about nature roughly in theocentric terms. They believe God created the world, even if he used evolutionary processes and so on to create life. They believe they have some responsibility to the world about them because of this and so on. It's certainly much easier to deal with the whole psychological reality of responsibility to a personal, loving, just God than it is to an impersonal nature who doesn't give a damn about you and me. In a sense, the bias against the theocentric position, the fact that it's very seldom discussed in public education, I think is unfortunate, both because it's a position that has a certain power to it as well as certain problems, and it's a position that is very, very widely held. Now, a theocentric view talks about God as creator, talks about God is valuing all of creation. Look at the book of Genesis, the constant refrain, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. And then at the end of the chapter, God looks over everything that he's created and says, and behold, it was very good. Here's a position then that shows respect and sees inherent value not just in sentient animals, but also in everything that exists. Even the inanimate has a certain intrinsic value. Nothing is to be despised as such. Even non-living things possess this kind of value. Within Western religion, you have concepts like the incarnation in Christianity, where God becomes man in Jesus Christ, takes on human flesh. This seems to present a view that sees humanness in terms of its earthiness, in terms of our somatic existence, not as inherently evil or problematic in the way, say, it was for Platonic dualism or for the ancient Gnostics or in some other religious traditions, but seems to take our humanness very, very seriously. Also within this tradition, you have emphasis on the life to come, the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead, but humans will have a bodily existence in the life to come. We will not be just disincarnated spirits. We will have some kind of a bodily existence, a difficult concept. Paul speaks of the spiritual body and so on, but something that's still significant. Christians and Jews and other religious traditions have a relatively easy time dealing with certain problems, as I presented in an earlier lecture, that transcend generations. One of the problems with classical liberalism and its focus on the autonomous individual self is how do you argue for intergenerational responsibility, for instance? Well, relatively easy for Jews and Christians because of the sense in which God transcends the generations, concepts like the concept of the church or the body of Christ or the people of God, all of those aid in that solving that kind of a problem. Biblical religion basically takes a hierarchical view of nature, which is similar in almost all respects, say, to the view of Aristotle in the philosophical tradition, that humans do have more value than other animals, but even among animals there seems to be some hierarchy in terms of how we value them and how we treat them. We've looked a little bit at Niebuhr and biblical materials and so on in terms of the whole problem of the self. And I think here, again, is one of the areas where there's a great deal of controversy today. One of the questions that's not often asked, or not asked, I think, as often as it should be in environmental ethics, is the question that we have focused on: what does it mean to be a human being? One of the more fascinating issues, we are very concerned as environmentalists, many of us, about nature, and we're very concerned to preserve nature, to conserve it, not to change it beyond recognition. But what about the preservation of human nature? You know, one of the really, really odd things today is that many people argue that human nature is totally a social construction, that there's no fixed human nature, that human nature is sort of whatever the society deems it to be. And this has produced some real crises in our society in terms of our concepts of law, the Constitution, and so on, because the founders talked about nature and nature's God. They talked about natural law. And when they held certain truths and certain rights to be self-evident, they held that because they believed that's the way humans were. That's the way they were created. But if human nature is infinitely plastic, and if you can't really say what human nature is, then what does it mean to talk about rights? And this is exactly the transition that we've seen in a lot of our law schools, that more and more rights are whatever the majority says they are. We talk of positive law rather than law based in the nature of human beings, the way the world is. But if the majority can create rights, they can also take rights away. And indeed, one of the critical problems we face in America today is it doesn't even seem to be the majority that creates rights. It's 9 Supreme Court justices that tell the rest of us how to live. We have increasingly an imperial judiciary that solves all the difficult questions for us by fiat. And that's one of the really cultural crises we face today, because when judges increasingly reject original intent in the Constitution, when they reject a concept of some sense of fixed human nature, then it looks like we resolve these questions just on the basis of political power. And that explains, of course, why appointments to the circuit and federal courts and the Supreme Court have become so extremely controversial. But what about preserving human nature? We're very intent on preserving nature, but if human nature is infinitely plastic and it's whatever we say it is, then we have this paradoxical situation that we seem less intent on preserving ourselves than on nature around us. And this simply is made hugely more serious with the advent of bioengineering. You know, we're in an incredible position today. We have come to a point where nobody seems to know what human nature is. You go down to the English department and to the law school, they said there's no such thing as human nature, it's just a social construct. And now we have the power to tamper with it and to fool with it and make out of it whatever we want. What the hell are we doing? You know, what are we going to do? This is a very, very deep and pervasive and serious societal and human crisis. The power to greatly change human nature, perhaps as C.S. Lewis presciently saw 50 years ago, maybe even to abolish human beings, this power, at the same time, we don't have the remotest idea, so say some, of what human beings are. That's worth thinking about, and at times it becomes almost downright depressing. Got a lot more material here, but let me stop here and get some reactions. I always like to know where you're at and what you're thinking. Yes, Gerald.
Your points on biocentrism, I wasn't exactly sure how you're saying that the fact that it's difficult to implement, like, in a political sense at one point. I don't understand really how that makes it an illegitimate ethical standpoint. Because aren't there a lot of ethical standpoints that would be difficult to implement?
Okay, I didn't mean politically difficult to implement, although I think it would be that too. I think it's personally almost impossible to implement, because how could you possibly live any kind of coherent life if you really try to act on the basis of what you consider true? And I'm taking a radical position here, the position of Paul Taylor in his book Respect for Nature. If a dandelion is as valuable as a human being, then I think the whole thing is totally incoherent. And it's interesting in his book that Taylor says almost nothing about how he would implement this vision. Aldo Leopold has a few statements that sound like that, but when you really unpack what he's saying and realize that he was in part writing as a poet as well as a scientist, I don't think he means exactly what he says sometimes in the literal words. But Taylor is a philosopher who tries to say very exactly what he means. But how would you live your daily life if a dandelion is as valuable as a human being. I absolutely can't get a hold of that, what that would mean. Does that... am I getting through it all? How do you operationalize that?
But aren't there many tragedies that they live through in terms of, for example, if you were to realize that you were responsible in some way, for example, if you pay taxes to a government which was doing unjust acts, you have to live with that realization that you're in some way supporting.
Of course.
But operate in that sense.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think we ought to minimalize these. In other words, why would one hold a belief that is so jarring and so counter to our ordinary common sense understandings? You know, virtually no one really believes that in terms of trying to put it into action, and that's what puzzles me with some of the biocentrics and occasionally some of the deep ecology writers, is why do they